Welcome back to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Our subject is age-related macular degeneration and natural lifestyle and nutritional strategies for preventing and treating it. In part one, we sort of laid the groundwork for a discussion in part two of what specifically should we do if, A, we are showing signs of macular degeneration, particularly the dry form, which is amenable to therapy, or B, how to prevent it. Because even if you don't have it, statistics show that the longer you live, the more likely you are to be at risk for macular degeneration. So before we get into targeted supplementation, because there are eye supplements that incorporate conclusions that research has led us to, what are some of the lifestyle strategies for optimal AMD support? I mean, there's some things that really we ought to do first and foremost, even before reaching for a supplement, correct?
Right. I mean, probably the most obvious, I think, that there's been studies is stopping smoking. If somebody's smoking, they certainly want to stop that. Not only exposure to secondhand smoke, the eye is extremely vulnerable to the oxidative damage of smoke. I think that goes without saying. I think if you look at the dietary patterns, I review the data showing that, you know, like you can probably recommend for almost every chronic disease, not eating like a Westerner is your best bet. So if you stop eating sort of refined foods, set, you know, an abundance of saturated trans fats, you know, refined sugars and these kind of things, that you're likely to have a lower risk for almost every chronic disease, and that includes macular degeneration. And in doing that, you typically increase your intake of colored fruits and vegetables. You reduce your glycemic impact, and I talk a little bit about the role of high glycemic impact foods that drive sort of some changes in the retina as well, which are negative. So you want to increase those phytonutrients that are going to be good for you, you know, higher fiber, lower sugar kind of things. And then, you know, being physically active. There's not a lot of data directly on intervention, but we do have enough data to suggest that being physically active does reduce your risk quite substantially in epidemiological studies of people that are fit, people that have a low BMI, people that have that eat, their dietary pattern is sort of Mediterranean or non-Western. They typically have a very dramatic, even up to a 70% reduction in the risk for AMD if you combine all three of those, if you're doing all three of those good behaviors. So lifestyle really is the biggest leveraging point. And, of course, adding these supplements on top of that would even be better in some cases.
Okay, so let's tackle the ARIDS study, which is really unique, I think, in nutritional science, because it's one of the few studies that conclusively demonstrates the advantage of nutritional supplements. So whenever you encounter someone who says, well, you know, vitamin supplements, they're not proven, there's no evidence that they really work, at the very least, you can hearken to these ARIDS studies, first compiled in the 1990s and then elaborated on in the early 2000s, which conclusively demonstrate an impact of nutritional supplementation on macular degeneration, right?
Right. So, you know, just briefly, going back to the early 90s, the National Eye Institute wanted to look into AMD, and they started doing what was called ARIDS at the time, age-related eye disease study. And when they were getting into this, they were basically looking at, you know, just the generic sort of AMD and also cataracts at the time. And it became obvious that during the midst of that study that the use of antioxidants was being explored in a number of smaller clinical trials. And so they decided that they were going to add a intervention arm. They were actually going to take some of these macular degeneration individuals and then put some of them on a supplementation at that time. And so that, again, that started in the mid-90s. And they put them on a regimen of what they called an antioxidants, which was vitamin C, 500 milligrams, vitamin E, 400 IUs, at the time, beta-carotene. And they used 15 milligrams of beta-carotene. And then they also gave them zinc, they chose, and we can talk about this later, but they chose 80 milligrams, a very high dose of mm-hmm. zinc with a small amount of copper.
Right.
They used the copper was basically there to inhibit the potential for a zinc-induced copper deficiency. Mm-hmm.
I think this is the reason for the selection of the high zinc was based on some research done by Craig Newsom at Louisiana State University, where he used an even higher dose. It was kind of a scary high dose, 120 milligrams, and that was suggestive of some benefit. Although, you know, we do have some concerns about high dose zinc.
Well, right, and there's a number of things going on there. Obviously, his study was not really even an AMD subjects per se. And then, of course, they chose zinc oxide, which is notoriously poor bioavailability, which may have offset some of the high dose in some cases. But the IOM, Institutes of Medicine, you know, basically considers 40 milligrams sort of the high upper limit. Now, that may not always be the highest you want to use in certain instances, but maybe as a daily supplement, 80 milligrams certainly seems fairly high. Mm-hmm. And so what they did is they essentially put you know, one of the group on placebo, one of the group on the antioxidant portion, one of the group on the zinc-only portion, and then obviously combine the two in the final group. And essentially, you know, they followed them for years. And the trial was published in 2001. So about six-year general follow-up, and obviously not everyone is in there for the full 6 years. But they found a pretty dramatic decrease, and let's say overall a 25 to 30% decrease in the advancement from sort of middle category AMD to a later stage of AMD. And part of the AREDS trial was actually creating grades or stages that didn't exist before this. So, from progressing from early to late stages or early to advanced stages, they were able to reduce the risk by about 25 to 30%, and had the greatest benefit when they saw the combination of the antioxidant and the zinc in this case.
One of the themes in your article about this is that it's not one nutrient; it's the synergy among these nutrients, because antioxidants work as a system. They're a constellation of nutrients which work together and tend to replenish one another to maintain some degree of control over free radical damage and inflammation.
Right, and if you think about this combination, and you know, knowing what we both know about a number of other antioxidants, these are actually very simple antioxidants. I mean, vitamin C, vitamin E, zinc, etc., are not complicated, nuanced sort of things. And of course, this is the mid '90s now, and so the group that they chose turned out to be a little more nourished than the average American. So these aren't people who are necessarily deficient or severely deficient in these, although they didn't typically measure the blood levels of these vitamins and minerals. But, you know, clearly they saw a clear statistical benefit. And because of the large size of the trial and the length of the trial and all these, they have a very strong statistical, benefit and statistical weight to the trial, which in some ways we'll talk in a minute, sort of backfired a little bit when they try to refine it using AREDS 2, which they didn't do it very well. They kind of complicated things by, you know, statistical analysis. And I can explain that in a minute.
Right. Okay. So AREDS 2, there was an add-on. They said, okay, great. The basic, ABC, you know, antioxidants, the ones that are the, you know, the real simple ones seem to confer some benefits. So in the next phase, they added lutein and zeaxanthin, or I believe lutein. Did they add zeaxanthin? I'm not even sure. And DHA, correct?
So right. So this wasn't an add-on to AREDS 1. This was a new set of patients, and they took some information, and in the interim, lutein and zeaxanthin, which were not available commercially when they first started AREDS 1, obviously became available, so they had lutein and zeaxanthin. The question about beta-carotene in smokers kind of let them think that they're going to go away. And then they had questions about the zinc dose. They wanted to modulate that, and of course, as you mentioned, wanted to see what omega-3 fatty acids did. Well, as I just enumerated, you can see there's lots of questions there. And so what they did was, unfortunately, they took the patients and they put some on placebo, some on what they call antioxidants, which is essentially just lutein and zeaxanthine, 10 milligrams of lutein, 2 milligrams of zeaxanthine, and then they put them on the EPA and DHA. So those were the three arms. But because of the way that research is done, they also had this problem that the success of ARIDS 1 meant that they had to tell all those subjects that were enrolled about the success of ARIDS 1. And then they had to give them the option for ethical reasons. They said, well, you know, we have to tell you how good this trial was, and you can choose to be on one of these other supplements. Well, of all of the subjects, only 19 decided not to take that. So basically, there weren't enough people on placebo and on placebo, meaning on the second phase placebo, where they took nothing. So all of the participants essentially were taking one form of the original ARIDS. And essentially what they did there is they said, if you're a smoker, you can't take the beta-carotene version. So they made a non-beta-carotene version. They made a low-zinc option, which was 25 milligrams instead of 80. And so they basically allowed
very complicated. To select one of those. It's so complicated, it's a little harder to analyze the data.
Right, so now you had two phases, no true placebo, and then when they basically discovered that essentially they had the same benefit as the original ARIDS. But the problem is they got the same, let's say, 25% benefit, but the statistical value, because they chopped it all up into these different areas, was weaker.
Right.
And so even though they went back and they looked at secondary analysis and found that, sure enough, the people that had the lowest dietary intake of lutein and zeaxanthine saw even stronger benefit when they took lutein and zeaxanthine. So that became out afterwards. But anyway, so go ahead. You had a question?
Yeah. So I'm going to try and summarize a little for our listeners. The second ARIDS, the problem was with the addition of the DHA and the lutein and zeaxanthine, it didn't appear that added a benefit. But that may have been just the result of a statistical fluke, because there weren't enough people to in the comparison group. But then when they looked at the people who were deficient in, probably weren't eating any fruits and vegetables, the added lutein zeaxanthine did make a difference when they reanalyzed the data.
Right. Obviously this was sort of one of those statistical complicated factors. That's where that secondary analysis came out. And unfortunately, the fact that it wasn't better than ARIDS made many people think that it didn't work.
Right.
When in fact, it did show that it was consistent with ARIDS. In fact, showing that the low zinc option was just as good as the regular zinc, that the lutein zeaxanthine turned out to be actually better. If you want to talk about the fact that the omega-3 in this particular instance didn't show any other benefits, but there may have been a reason for that, perhaps because of low bioavailability and individual differences in how people absorb omega-3 fatty acids.
Sure, go ahead. Why don't you touch on that? I think the pill they used was like a mixture of DHA and EPA, but weighted towards DHA predominantly.
Well, initially, the first one was weighted towards EPA.
Oh, okay.
And also, it was a 2-to-1 EPA to DHA, so that would be sort of opposite of what we would typically think about. And it was also in the ethyl ester form, and I think we've talked about this, that there's data showing the triglyceride form is better. So that was one hint. Then there was actually a different clinical trial that wasn't part of this. It's a different clinical trial that looked at a triglyceride form, which was more
DHA. By the way,
DHA.
Just for our listening audience, the triglyceride form is the type that you get if you get a doctor's prescription for fish oil. That's the ester form. Excuse me, am I correct here?
Yes.
Because the most supplement companies.
Yeah, the ethyl ester form.
Yeah, most supplement companies are now using the triglyceride form. Like the orthomolecular supplement, which I recommend, and many of the other supplements, I think, Nordic Naturals, they use the triglyceride form, which, according to your analysis,
right.
And you shared that with us.
Most of them will list that on the label, and some supplement companies use triglycerides, some use ethyl esters, and most of them list that on the label. But the interesting thing is there was a different clinical trial called the NAT2 study, which stands for Nutritional AMD Treatment 2. and they looked at a DHA, 840 milligrams of DHA versus 270 EPA. So it was obviously heavily weighted in the DHA as a reesterified triglyceride. And what they discovered was that if you look at the individuals who actually increase their EPA and DHA, you can do that measuring red blood cell phospholipids, and we call that the omega-3 index.
Right.
So the individuals who actually incorporated the EPA and DHA into their cells had a statistical, a pretty massive statistical drop in their risk for AMD and the progression of AMD. So this points out the fact that just because you're giving somebody fish oil does not necessarily mean they're incorporating it. And that's why it's important to understand that, and of course, ARIDS 2 did not even ask that question. Mm-hmm. They might have used the wrong product, but they also didn't ask the question. I believe if they probably went back and looked at omega-3 index, which unfortunately they did measure at baseline, so we can't do it now, but they would probably see the same thing, that those people who incorporated the most EPA and DHA into the cells got the best benefit.
That's a very interesting point. You know, what you take isn't necessarily what you absorb. Another way of saying that is not you are what you eat, it's you are what you absorb. Okay, so what does this lead us to conclude in terms of the optimal nutritional program for macular degeneration, you know, based on the research?
Right. So what I tell people is that when you look at research in this area, you know, the good part of ARIDS and ARIDS 2 is that we've got these very large, well-done clinical trials funded by the government, and I think the data is not much in dispute. The problem with that is that everyone only relies sometimes upon those. So there's a lot of ophthalmologists that are clinging to sort of the ARIDS 1 formula because even with beta carotene, no lutein, and high zinc, because they're seeing, you know, the p-value or the statistical value of that study was really good. So that's part of, you know, that can be sort of a wrong-headed way to interpret this. What I tell people is if you have AMD or you want to think about preventing or the advancing of AMD, you should probably, as a baseline minimum supplementation, you should choose an ARIDS 2-like formula. I would think the low zinc option is your better bet just because I think it gives you more flexibility to add zinc if you need later. And I typically prefer a zinc that's something like a zinc chelate or some other zinc, not zinc oxide.
Right.
But I would consider adding on an omega-3 fatty acid that's DHA rich. I think that's sort of baseline supplementation for anybody at risk with AMD. I think the data is very clear that that's going to be preventative and helpful for them.
Mm-hmm. What about the lutein and zeaxanthin? And then there are also some revved up forms of zeaxanthin which are now being promoted. Could you speak to that?
Right. So I think when I say ARIDS 2, that would include 10 milligrams of lutein, 2 milligrams of zeaxanthin. And again, I would say that's baseline. I think I have data in here showing that at 10 milligrams of lutein, the individual variability of absorption is really high. And if you get somebody to 12 milligrams, you diminish that quite a bit and you increase the ability to increase the macular pigment because you can measure that. The density of the macular pigment goes up when you give somebody 20 milligrams and maybe even better at 30 milligrams because, you know, obviously the more you give, the higher it'd be. So what I say baseline would be at 10 milligrams, ARIDS 2 level. Certainly you could add more, and, you know, without any issue. You mentioned mesozeaxanthin. Mesozeaxanthin actually is a xanthophyll, which is a isomer. It's like in between, let's say it's in between lutein and zeaxanthin in its molecular structure. And the eye converts lutein to mesozeaxanthin. So all three of them are actually found in the eye. And, because of that, somebody went along and said, well, what if we create a synthetic, and I'll put synthetic in quotes here, from lutein, from marigolds? You can take lutein and you can isomerize it in a lab or in a factory, and then you can sell mesozeaxanthin. And so there's a number of people that are looking at this, and there's many people touting it and marketing it as, you know, better, you know, more effective. When you add it to lutein, not by itself, but when you add it to lutein. And I reviewed the data on that, and I believe that they have not proven that yet. There actually is a large clinical trial going on in Ireland that they're attempting to prove that the addition of mesozeaxanthin, which really isn't a dietary carotenoid, but it is a dietary carotenoid now that it's a supplement. Mm-hmm. So they would have to show that because of the extra cost that it was of value. So we're probably going to have to wait 2 or 3 years before we get that data. And my gut feeling is that it's going to be marginally better, if at all. I don't think it's going to be dramatically better just because of the nature of the fact that lutein can convert to mesozeaxanthine on its own.
Okay. Is there an orthomolecular product that incorporates your recommendations?
So basically, we did put together a product called OcuView, which follows the exact recommendations I just made to you, that it's an ARIDS 2 formula, essentially. And the only addition that we believe was strong from the data and from the mechanism is the addition of lipoic acid.
Okay.
Lipoic acid, as you know, is a very functional antioxidant and has been shown to be very beneficial in the eye. But that's the only addition. And the reason we did that is because of sort of, I would say, perhaps a strong loyalty to the ARIDS or ARIDS 2 formulas. And when you deviate too far from them, there are people who just don't want to, quote-unquote, risk going away from the very statistical type data that's there. So we wanted mm-hmm. to stay within the evidence-based model, which is very, helpful for people who are just getting into this, and certainly for ophthalmologists that really trust the ARIDS and ARIDS 2
right.
data.
And what's interesting is that there are many conventional doctors refuse to acknowledge the benefits of nutritional supplements or recommend them for their patients. But I think it's almost universal among ophthalmologists to recommend some kind of eye supplement, whether it's the Bausch and Lomb one based on ARIDS 1, which we think is kind of skimpy and inadequate, or the more advanced ARIDS 2 supplements like OcuView that you described.
Right. Let me point out one other thing that I think trips up a few people is that some of the companies out there are now creating a number of different targeted supplements. One, let's say some that don't have the zinc in it, some that don't have other portions in it, and it's because they believe that there are certain genetic types that require zinc where zinc could be damaging. Hmm. We actually investigated that research. There's actually a genetic testing company that's sort of promoting this idea,
right.
And they've published on this. But we actually looked in the broader literature, and we now think that data probably is not good, and there is no reason to use genetic testing to find a product without zinc or with zinc or mm-hmm. without another ingredient in there. And so we think that data is not strong, and people shouldn't be sort of using their genetic test to decide what supplement to take specifically for AMD.
It's too far ahead of the curve, not yet ready for prime time information. What about the B vitamins?
Right.
Because there seems to be a homocysteine connection or a methylation connection to degenerative changes in the eyes.
So, right, there's a strong epidemiological correlation with low B vitamins and elevated homocysteine levels with AMD, and there's even an intervention trial that was using sort of a homocysteine-lowering therapy, which for the most part is folates, B6 and B12. And, of course, we all know that this is sort of has been looked at as a risk for cardiovascular disease, and sometimes it's been disappointing in its inability to reduce cardiovascular disease, but that's another topic. But in this particular study, they actually looked at it for cardiovascular disease, and they found that they saw a statistical drop in AMD risk progression.
Hmm.
So there seems to be some benefit in the use of B vitamins. I think most people, if they're having an advanced disease, they're probably on a multivitamin and maybe like a B complex. For most people, that's going to be enough. But certainly if a doctor is concerned about this, they should probably measure homocysteine levels. And certainly if they're above 10 and certainly if they're above 13, they should be looking at lowering them to below 10, 9, maybe in that range.
And a couple of others, selenium, taurine, glutathione, might they play a role in retarding macular degeneration?
Yeah, so at the end of the paper, what we try to do is review sort of a broad spectrum, and there's a number of different supplemental ingredients, like you mentioned, taurine, carnitine, to sort of semi, although technically non-essential nutrients because our body can synthesize them, but they have been shown, both of them have shown to be very important for retinal function. Carnitine actually has a clinical trial, small clinical trial. It was combined with CoQ10, so it's a little hard to know how much of that was the CoQ10 and how much was that the carnitine. It was a modest effect. And then, as you mentioned, glutathione. Glutathione, I don't typically recommend oral glutathione, mm-hmm. Although they're gaining some momentum on some data, perhaps, that it might be helpful. But really, the stronger data is in what we call glutathione precursors. And, of course, lipoic acid is one of those, but acetylcysteine is probably the other big one that we think of. And then other things that you'd get in the diet, like quercetin, sulforaphane, which you would get from broccoli, silymarin, which is milk thistle, or selenium, like you mentioned. All of these, and, of course, many more, can stimulate the body's own synthesis of glutathione or its reductions, because you need reduced glutathione in order to be really active. So, not surprisingly, you know, that's what a complex, you know, colored fruits and vegetable diet will deliver for you.
And on one other final note is that among lifestyle factors, alcohol, while thought to be beneficial for cardiovascular disease, you know, a little bit of alcohol, a little red wine, that's beneficial, but turns out not beneficial for macular degeneration? Is it? Is there a dose-dependent effect with alcohol consumption?
Well, it's not. I mean, this is one of those things where when we say limit alcohol consumption, yeah, it's where that threshold is. Usually when people are consuming alcohol, they're, you know, you've got other things in there. So if it's beer, you've got, you know, all kinds of phytonutrients potentially. With wine, you have that as well. But it seems like if people are, there's not a strong correlation like you see with other diseases, and it seems like excessive alcohol is related to advanced AMD. So our general recommendation is to limit it. I think that's probably fits within most modest recommendations that clinicians give to their patients.
Okay. Well, you've given us a very wonderful comprehensive rundown of the research on macular degeneration. So what's today's Intelligent Medicine call to action? First of all, we urge our listeners to check out pointinstitute.org, where you can find lots of information, some monographs available on other subjects. All this one has not yet been published, correct? Or is not yet made available via the,
it's not, the website? It's been published and it's available through the light. It's available through thelifestylematrix.com. It's not yet online for a free download yet.
Okay. Thelifestylematrix.com is the place to go, especially for clinicians who want to get some really sophisticated information on macular degeneration. But in terms of news you can use, we've shared this with our listeners, and they can follow these recommendations to a successful outcome. So thank you very much for drilling down on this important subject, and it's certainly a resounding success story for lifestyle and supplement intervention, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's actually remarkable that this is the standard of care, and most people have almost ignored it in some ways.
Right. So while we're waiting for a magic bullet that may take a long time to arrive, this is the way to go. Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Thomas Williams.
You're welcome. I enjoyed it immensely.
I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and this is the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Mm-hmm.